Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Stephen Zunis, and he will be speaking on Jewish and Muslim perspectives. So let's listen in on Stephen Zunis.
Before I even give you the title, we're supposed to keep the title short, and I didn't keep my title short enough, so the last four words of the title were left off the announcements. The announcements are, the official title is Jewish and Muslim Perspectives on the Middle East. And we just announced as Jewish and Muslim Perspectives, so in question and answer period, if you want to get on the broader perspectives, that would be just fine. I also just wanted to pass out a little flyer. You're welcome to take or leave dealing with the institutes that I direct. We do peace education for the religious community, community groups, and academic community and beyond. But I usually like to start these things with just a short moment of silent prayer, meditation, reflection. Spend about 10 or 15 minutes looking at sort of a Muslim view of the contemporary Middle East, and followed by another 10 or 15 minutes looking at the Jewish perspectives. But I want to real briefly, for those who, fortunately, because of some very exciting, worthwhile interfaith efforts, more and more Christians seem to know at least the basics of Judaism. We remain, unfortunately, profoundly ignorant in large part of Islam. But briefly, Islam is very closely related to the Judeo-Christian religion. Allah is simply the Arabic word for God. It's the same God. Islam is a monotheistic faith. Grew out directly from Judaism and Christianity. Their belief is that God is the center of the universe, omnipotent, just, and merciful. Humankind is God's highest creation, but is limited and commits sin, can be tempted by Satan. They see Jesus like they do the other, like the Old Testament prophets, as one of the great prophets. They do not accept Jesus as the Messiah, but still think very, very highly of Jesus as they do Abraham and others. We often see Islam in some of its more reactionary manifestations, and I don't forget the schedule, but I will be, I believe, on Thursday talking some about what's behind the Islamic resurgence in the Middle East and what are some manifestations of that. But I want to look at more generally an issue of how Muslims see contemporary Middle East and its relationship with the West. And one important perspective is to look at the legacy of the Crusades. The Crusades bear a remarkable scar on the Muslim world. To the Muslims, they see this as an unforgivable act of imperialist aggression that was clothed in religious language, but in fact was a power grab by any definition. Indeed, they point to the fact that Arab Christians were persecuted by the conquering Crusaders in the brave pillage, burning, massacres were inflicted upon Christian Arab villages just as they were against Muslim Arab villagers by the conquering European armies. And indeed, Christians fought alongside Saladin in ridding the Arab world of the conquerors. And the Muslims look at their history and see that, as it says in the Quran, their holy book, that Jews and Christians are people of the book. That they, well, you can never be equal to a Muslim. I mean, after all, if you don't accept the final and greatest prophet Muhammad, you can't be equal. At least they should be treated with respect and accepted. Indeed, when there's been widespread persecution of, say, Jews in Europe, as in the late 15th century in Spain, it was a Muslim world where Jews could flee. So there has been a tradition of tolerance. Less tolerance, to be sure, of heretics and heathens, but that could be, certainly could be said of almost any other religion. But this legacy of conquest, not just the Crusades, but other incursions throughout the centuries, the double crossing of the Arabs by the Europeans at the end of World War I, they thought they would get independence from Turkey, only to have decades of European rule, has left widespread bitter resentment. They, and again today, they say that they look no further than Bosnia to raise the question, if it was a Muslim country invading and massacring and committing ethnic cleansing against a Christian country, would the world have stood by? In Lebanon, they saw how in the 1970s, a Muslim-led but pluralistic movement, known as the Lebanese National Movement, was crushed in large part because of Western support for the Falangists, a neo-fascist movement led by Maronite Christians, which succeeded with the Israeli invasion in 1982 of imposing a minority government on Lebanon, which was supported by the U.S. Navy and intervention by U.S. Marines in the years following. And there is also a lot of confusion and anger about this obsession that the West has with terrorism. They pointed out how Israel has killed many, many times more civilians in its bombing raids in Lebanon and its repression of occupied territories than have Palestinian-related groups committed terrorist acts against Jews. They have noted how the U.S. bombing of Libya back in 1986 killed nearly 100 civilians, far more than the number of civilians killed by terrorist groups that were allegedly connected to the Libyan government. And more recent evidence has come out suggesting that indeed Libya wasn't behind its terrorist acts that prompted the bombing in the first place. They also point to the fact that the U.S.-backed Contras in Nicaragua that were armed, trained, essentially created by the U.S. government, were, according to international journalists, human rights activists, and other outside monitors, responsible for far more civilian deaths than all the terrorist attacks by all the Arab and Muslim groups for the past 20 years combined. And so there is a lot of resentment and a lot of suspicion about where is the West really coming from. They see that many of the governments that the U.S. supports the most are among the most corrupt and dictatorial in that part of the world. And there seems, and they're very quick to look to point out hypocrisy and certain sanctimonious concerns the West around human rights and the like when they see the U.S. giving large-scale economic and military aid to governments like Israel and Egypt and Morocco and Turkey, which engaged in widespread systematic human rights violations and send massive arms to governments like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, and others, which have similarly bad human rights records and are corrupt to boot. And of course, the biggest issue of all, of course, involves Israel. That to Muslims, they see Zionism not as a legitimate national liberation movement for Jews, but as a return of a European conquest of sacred Arab land in the guise of a religious movement. They point to the fact that the majority, that Zionism's founding fathers were Europeans, that the those who founded Israel were Europeans. The government and industrial elite in Israel are of European background. The countries that have backed Israel have been European and North American. That they have expanded their territory far beyond the 50% of Palestine, which was originally granted them by the United Nations to incorporate nearly 80% of Palestine in the 48 war, all of Palestine by 1967 and beyond.
Well, wouldn't you call that the Muslims' fault? Because they attacked them twice.
I am talking about the Muslim perspective. We can talk about the other perspective.
Oh, okay.
But it also depends on the war. Three of the five wars were started by Israel. Two of the five wars were started by the Arab side. Talk about that in a little more detail. Furthermore, they look at that now that virtually all the Arab countries have agreed to go by the United Nations, Resolutions 242 and 338, calling for land for peace. Now the Palestinians have unilaterally recognized Israel and say, we'll only take 23% of Palestine as the West Bank and Gaza. Israel still refuses to grant Palestinian independence. And this only reinforces the idea that this is in fact a part of an effort by the West to use Israel for this expansion. And particularly sensitive is the issue of Jerusalem, which is a holy site in Islam, as well as, of course, Judaism and Christianity. And there is quite a bit of concern, for example, the Clinton administration's shift on Jerusalem, and unlike all previous U.S. administrations, has essentially endorsed the Israeli annexation of Greater Jerusalem to make it exclusively Israeli territory, when most Muslims around the world would like to either see it as a Muslim territory or at least one that can be shared between all three major faiths. Now, and the repeated bias they see in the West towards Israel, they get sanctimonious about Iraq's take over Kuwait and go to war to enforce United Nations Security Council resolutions and to stop the gross human rights violations Iraq committed on Kuwait and to end the illegal expansion of a country's territory by force, all of which I think most Muslims would acknowledge that Iraq did indeed do to Kuwait. Yet, on Israel, we either veto or refuse to enforce similar UN resolutions involving Israel expansion, and not only that, we arm and support the occupiers. This double standard made it very easy for Saddam Hussein to use a lot, even though Saddam Hussein is secular, in fact, has persecuted Muslim religious movements, and is as most people agree, is not in fact a practicing Muslim at all, was able to manipulate this kind of resentment in the Muslim world to his side. Another irony that many Muslims point out is that many of the more hardline, fanatic Muslim movements have actually had tacit support from the U.S. For example, Hamas, the extremist Muslim Palestinian group, gets most of its funding from members of the Kuwaiti and Saudi royal family that are supported by the United States. Similarly, of the 7 different factions fighting the communist government in Afghanistan, the Soviet puppet regime there, the CIA sent virtually 80% of all U.S. support to the most hardline extremist fundamentalist faction, the one that has led to a not very well publicized, but actually horrendous mass persecution civil war that continues in Afghanistan to this day. Indeed, the New York Times recently revealed that a Egyptian sheikh, a very hardline right-wing fundamentalist sheikh, who ties to terrorist groups, was given a waiver and was allowed to get in, despite being on terrorist watch list, to the United States because he was recruiting American Muslims to fight with the Mujahideen. His name is Sheikh Rahman, who has since been indicted in connection with the World Trade Center bombing. And he was actually he and his followers were considered CIA assets because of their links to the Afghan Mujahideen.
If you could back up for just a minute to the Kuwaiti-Iraq war, that's been confusing to me from a Muslim perspective because it's a Muslim internal issue in some ways. And what the tone you've been taking so far has kind of, I mean, I have some serious problems with Kuwait's human rights record, but I really don't have a sense of how they are, as a Muslim country, seen in the Muslim world. Could you say a little more about that?
Sure. Basically, the Kuwaitis are seen as very, well, one of the 5 pillars of Islam is charity. And Islam and the Kuwait and sort of share the wealth kind
yes.
of, and the Kuwaitis have done anything but. They invest the oil, the oil wealth, which most Muslims and Arabs see as common property, into the West, into the stock market, real estate, gambling, casinos, Monte Carlo, real estate in London, whatever, and it's seen as very, very corrupt. And although nominally Muslim, they will do things that may be within the letter of the law, but not really. For example, I forget if it's the king or his brother. In Islam, you can't have more than 4 wives, and only then they have to be treated equally. But what he does is, at the end of each week, he divorces a wife and marries another.
Oh.
And he's done doing this for years.
Open door policy.
Yeah, which, any self-respecting Muslim would say, now that is not what they meant, That is, and a lot of this kind of thing. So the corruption is widespread. And so even Saddam Hussein wasn't well-respected either. I think almost every Muslim recognized that he's incredibly tyrannical and, everything else. There wasn't a lot of sympathy for the Kuwaitis when they got taken over. A lot of Muslims thought they had it coming, in a sense.
Okay.
Even though, again, they didn't think Saddam Hussein was a great guy. But basically, when the West weighed in on the side of the Kuwaiti royal family, it just sort of reinforced this perspective that these sheikhs are just puppets for the West, West imperialists, and Saddam Hussein, though he may be as this nasty character, at least he sticks up for the Arabs, and he's a nationalist, etc. So basically, Saddam Hussein was, able to use legitimate grievances for illegitimate ends, like any good demagogue has been able to do historically.
Use the phrase Arabs and Muslims.
Okay, the Arabs are people who speak Arabic, basically, and they stretch from North Africa, much of the Middle East. Their ethnic roots are in the Arabian Peninsula. Muslims are those who profess to the Islamic religion. Vast majority of Arabs are Muslim, but there are also large Christian minorities in a number of countries, and they're generally treated pretty well in those. Most Muslims, however, are not Arabs. The largest Muslim country, for example, is Indonesia, Southeast Asia. There are about 50 million Muslims in India, a similar number in the former Soviet Union, a Iran and Turkey are Islamic countries, but are not Arab, and there are Arab fairly sizable Arab populations in countries like Malaysia, other places in Southeast Asia, throughout Black Africa, and even some pockets here in the world as well. I want to move to a Jewish perspective. Jewish perspective, so I wanted to see if there's anything currently with that area. And just in general, I hope that we'll have a good 20 minutes or more for discussion at the end. Feel free to interrupt midstream if there's something.
Wasn't there an issue about Kuwait actually being part of Iraq?
That was the excuse, but in fact, while Kuwait had been lumped together in the Basra province under the Ottoman rule, the Kuwaitis had been at least a city-state with their own distinct identity for at least 350 years. Now, the boundary between Kuwait and Iraq was drawn arbitrarily deliberately by the British to the disadvantage of the Iraqis. But there has been a Kuwait national identity for a number of centuries, so claims that have been part of the story of Iraq are phony, especially since Iraq itself is a pretty artificial collection of what were three separate areas that were sort of put together also by the British. So it's a funny excuse, and most people familiar with the region didn't take it seriously.
Is there any truth to the charge of waiting for slant drilling?
It's possible. I don't know. I wouldn't have put it past them, but I wouldn't have passed it. I'm seeing it make it up here. So. Now, when Jews look at the Middle East, they see the Holy Land, what they see is Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, an area that has had strong, strong attachment for many centuries, and 2,000 years of the diaspora. It's been a long, long-standing dream of returning. Indeed, as you attend the Passover Seder, know the final word line is next year in Jerusalem, as it's been for many, many centuries. And land. Actually, having land is particularly important for Jews because historically Jews were not allowed to own land. In Europe and then elsewhere, they actually have to have land, and this land where their ancestors are. Every Israeli is an amateur archaeologist. They see the amazing things that their ancestor did. There's a real attachment there. I'm sure many of you know personally Jews who have no intention of moving to Israel themselves, but for whom Israel is very, very, very important to them. And while and many Jews feel very defensive when one starts challenging certain things the Israeli government has done. And indeed, many things the Israeli government has done deserve challenge. In the creation of Israel, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were forcibly driven from their land. It was ethnic cleansing. And it was one of the most horrific atrocities of the post-World War II era. The human rights record of Israel in the occupied territories is horrendous. Mass expulsion, demolitions of home, confiscation of property, tens of thousands of political prisoners, torture on administrative bases, shooting in crowds, including children. Bad news by any measure. Defiance of the most basic principles of international law, the United Nations. We could go down the list. There are plenty of things to be critical of Israel about. But many Jews would be concerned that many people use this as an excuse to say, therefore Israel should not exist. But when you think about it, almost every country in the world today came into creation by rather horrendous acts against the indigenous population. Our own country being a very, very clear example. Indeed, many European countries, France and England, the Celts and the Franks the Anglo-Saxons and the Franks were outsiders who came in. Indeed, most so-called Arab countries weren't always Arab. They were a result of the invasions out of the Arabian Peninsula around the 6th and 7th century. And yes, the fact that it's been a more immediate thing is something, at least in the Palestinian situation, that some of the wrongs can be reversed, at least to some degree. To say that therefore this country has no right to exist smacks of hypocrisy at best and anti-Semitism at worst. Indeed, though Israel has a really horrendous human rights record, so do most Middle Eastern countries have horrendous human rights records. And Israel is the only U.S. ally that has used their weapons to bomb civilians and terrible things. And Zion, and certainly there's just that Zionism is racist. I mean, certainly there's certain racist policies in the Israeli government, certainly racist things in the name of Zionism. There's a frightening, those of you in Israel can vouch for the fact there's a lot of racism among individual Israelis. That Zionism, like any national liberation movement, is diverse. It's not racist per se. That every national liberation movement has progressive, inclusive, pluralistic elements and racist, chauvinistic, militaristic elements. And to lump Zionism all with the latter is as unfair as lumping Islam or Palestinian nationalism or any kind of movement with the most hardline elements. Indeed, some of the worst atrocities committed by the Israeli government were in large part as a result of Western support. And something that it was not anything inherent within the movement itself. Another way one could look at it, and many Jews get defensive around this, is really wondering that even when is the fact that it's the only Jewish state in the world. I mean, think about it for a moment. If there's only one Christian state in the world, we'd quite likely be defensive against criticisms because we wonder if there's ulterior motive. There's only one black state in the world. Imagine African Americans would be defending it left and right, even if it was run by Idi Amin or somebody. There's always a fear that even if an individual Jew may agree with a particular criticism of Israel, that the criticism is motivated not out of some universalist ethic of human rights or international law or right of self-determination or whatever, but as an excuse to criticize the world's only Jewish state. Again, this example yesterday in my talk, went to a national convention of the Palestine Human Rights Campaign, which does some very worthwhile work in the human rights situation over there. But I remember sitting at a banquet table and noticing one person at the table talking about how the Palestinian Human Rights Campaign should make alliance with the Liberty Lobby. The Liberty Lobby being an extreme right-wing neo-fascist group that denies the Holocaust ever happened. It's just a very scary group. Another one at the table was wearing a South African Kruger hand around her neck, the gold coin minted by the apartheid government. And I couldn't help but think, why are these people here, really? And I think you'll find that a lot of critics of Israel, while the criticisms themselves may have some validity, have some ulterior motives behind them. And so, for example, a Jewish person may hear me or any one of you rattling off a number of things that we don't like that the Israeli government may have done. But there's not a Jew in the world that can't think, why are they saying that, really? Even if they agree with the actual things we're saying. Because you don't know where that person is really coming from. Because there's a lot of anti-Semitism out there.
Could you speak about the place of the Holocaust in it?
Yes, and the Holocaust was in many ways the culmination of anti-Semitism, where Jews would essentially would be, in a given country, as a minority. There would almost be a tacit agreement between the ruling elites of a given country and certain representatives in the Jewish community that will give you a degree of cultural and religious autonomy if, in return, you can do the dirty work for us. You be the visible agents of the oppressive order. You be the moneylenders, the tax collectors, or the managerial class, or whatever. So what would happen when people in these given countries would rise up against social injustice, the elites who had the real power would say, oh, it's the Jews. They're the cause of your problems. People turn on the Jews and have the pogroms, the massacres, Jews had fled into another country, the cycle would start all over again. The idea behind Zionism was that Jews could have their own nation. They could then be free of the whims of a given ruling class. And so Jews are very defensive about this, because this is the one place, for the first time in thousands of years, Jews have a place they can go if things get rough somewhere. Jacobo Timmerman, who's a famous Argentine dissident and journalist, who's a Jew, who was subjected to torture and persecution, was able to flee to Israel. And he was so happy Israel was there. And he's a big critic of the Israeli government. His son went to jail for refusing to serve in the invasion of Lebanon, and he was attacked in the media because he was, you know, supported Palestinian rights and criticized Israeli government, supported the Argentine junta that tortured him, and that kind of thing. He said, yeah, I'm still getting harassed for my political beliefs, but at least I'm not being persecuted as a Jew. And that was real important to have that. Of course, the irony is that in many ways the Western powers, initially France and Britain, and more recently the U.S., has essentially been using Israel to do our dirty work in that part of the world, and once again the Jews get scapegoated. We even see here in domestic politics that we blame the Jewish lobby for the pro-Western, the pro-Israel bias of our government, instead of looking at the fact that we don't need a pro-Indonesian lobby to support the takeover of East Timor, or pro-Moroccan lobby to support the takeover of Western Sahara, or other misdeeds by other allies. I'm firmly convinced that U.S. policy in the Middle East is very consistent with U.S. policy elsewhere. We'll support any pro-Western government against any third world radical nationalist movement. But, you know, again, this idea to, you know, blame that these politicians can say, oh, it's not our fault, those rich Jews are behind the scenes manipulating us. Similarly, get a lot of criticism about the massive amounts of U.S. foreign aid going to Israel, which is like nearly over $4 billion a year, which comes out to a good $1,200 per Israeli man, woman, and child. So we're talking about 36% of all U.S. foreign aid going to a country that's only 1/1000th of the population. It's several times what we give to the entire continent of Africa. And these statistics you hear about, people saying, well, it's terrible, these Jews are taking all our money. But in fact, almost all U.S. aid to Israel comes back to the United States. The Israelis never see it, because it goes to American arms manufacturers, or it goes to American banks as interest on previous loans. So in effect, USA to Israel, so-called, is a continuation of Reaganomics. You're taking money from middle-class taxpayers and getting to the bankers and arms manufacturers. But again, the Jews become the scapegoat. And the scapegoating phenomenon is widespread, and Jews feel it and get very defensive about it. So there's a so people see and so that's why you see a lot of defensiveness around Israel. I'm sure you all know people that have Jewish friends who are very conscientious about injustice and war and peace issues and human rights issues around the world. When it comes to Israel, they get really rigid and they start talking, you know, like a bunch of far right wing whatevers, you know. I think this is the reason that there is this level of defensiveness that's out there, and the sense that Israel is again being singled out for its misdeeds. Many of the United Nations resolutions against Israel have been quite valid, but many were less so, and many were incredibly hypocritical when we once saw far worse misdeeds committed by of certain other countries that people got away with. While Israel gets away with a lot it shouldn't, probably, in terms of our government's role, I think in other areas, Israel does get more than a share of attacks on others. But in many ways, it just falls into this sort of setting up scapegoat kind of thing. You have these reactionary regimes in the Middle East and elsewhere in the third world blaming Zionism for their problems, instead of looking at where the real power is in the international economic order and the like. And so that's what's so tragic about the situation, is that you have both perspectives. You know, that we have two religious groups that have very, who are our cousins for all intents and purposes, all children of Abraham, who are share many of the more important aspects of our own faith at odds with each other, and very suspicious of Western Christendom, given the history of persecution. And I think that also shows, I think we have a certain responsibility as Christians, as Western Christians, to be sensitive to these perceptions. And as we work to be peacemakers, and as we work to look at our government's policy towards that part of the world, as well as our own attitudes and prejudices and that kind of thing, to be aware of how other people might see it, that that the anger, confusion, mistrust doesn't come out of nowhere. The use of extremist tactics by both Israelis and Arabs is not a reflection of their religious tradition, but a reflection of how they've been hurt, and how they are angry, and how they are confused, and how this kind of history can lead to these kinds of reactions.
Does the fact that the British had two different policies that conflicted with each other, they supported the Israelis in setting up Zion, and at the same time they tried to prevent the Israelis from going there, mm-hmm. and were supporting the Arabs, how does this play into it?
Classic colonial divide and rule, basically, and looking at the interests of the empire above the interests. Yes, for lack of a better, I'm sure there are some idealistic people within somewhere in the bureaucracy who are trying to make the best of it, but I think by and large it was power politics at its worst, and as with India and Pakistan and other places, we are still feeling the legacy of the empire and its decline to this day.
Is there anything in the Islamic faith which would easily lend itself to fundamentalism?
Well, first of all, fundamentalism is probably not a good term as a Protestant term, but in the sense of there is a somewhat more literalistic interpretation of the Quran than there is in most Western Christian interpretations of the Bible. Also, the Quran goes into much more detail about how one lives one's life and one sets up societal institutions than one might find in Christianity and Judaism. At the same time, the Quran, like the Bible, has certain internal contradictions and is subjected to a wide variety of interpretations. I think where you see, if you look at the places in the Middle East and where so-called fundamentalism has really, or the reactionary, militaristic, intolerant variety, it's been places where people have been subjected to enormous economic and social dislocation. Iran, where the U.S. overthrew the constitutional government, the CIA intervened in 1953, overthrew Mossadegh, installed the Shah as a brutal dictator, killing tens of thousands of his own people, widespread torture and abuse, opened the country up to Western military and economic influence, because he was a megalomaniac building palaces and everything for him while most of the people were suffering. He turned the country from the next exporter of food to an importer of 80% of them as basic food stuff. So he'd go on the list of the damage the Shah did. And that was all done in the name of modernization. And the Shah persecuted and killed off almost all moderate, liberal, socialist, secular opponents. The one place he could not get into was the mosques. And that's, so when the revolution finally came, which in hindsight was inevitable given the situation, it happened to take this particularly, not only to an Islamic tent, but also a particularly reactionary form of Islam. And initially, actually, Islamic Revolution in Iran had some fairly moderate, progressive elements. but they were all purged within 1 or 2 years, and the more hardened elements have reigned ever since. Egypt, Tunisia, and Tunisia, two North African countries, are where, again, open-door Western policies has greatly disrupted the traditional economy, an influx of literally millions of people from the countryside to the cities. What can they identify with? But the mosques, again, taking advantage of the disillusionment and unemployment. Again, the Western thought is, you know, these high-rise skyscrapers while people starve, these wealthy elites getting richer and richer while the poor are poor. Women's liberation means prostitution and women with, you know, short skirts and makeups and you know, dance halls and, you know, because that's what they see. And again, the egregious reaction. If you look at Gaza Strip, these people were totally thrown off their land, lived in refugee camps for decades. When the secular, more moderate leadership decides to finally make peace with Israel, Israel still refuses to recognize Palestinian statehood. Again, they turn to the extreme. In Lebanon, where much of the southern part of the country has been bombed smithereens by the Israelis over the years, creating a massive flood of refugees into the cities. Again, it's supposed to remember there's been Western influence in ways that have been very disruptive. One exception has been Algeria, where their Islamic reaction was a result of their own indigenous screw-ups of a totalitarian revolutionary government that got very cocky and had a kind of Soviet-style heavy industrialization at the expense of the agricultural sector, which led to a similar dislocation and alienation, which has led to the Islamic reaction there. But countries where there has been some degree of involvement, participation, people have some degree of control of their lives, you generally have not seen this kind of reaction. And you'll get no finalists, just like communism in third world countries. They came to countries where there was the most repression, the most inequality. I mean, indeed, most of the Islamic movements in the Middle East, 20, 30 years ago, the same people would have been Marxists, probably. In fact, a number of them were Marxists. And Islam just happened to be a ready-made ideology they can attach to, you know, carry people's grievances. And again, it's unfortunate it's taken such a totalitarian and reactionary element. But again, the grievances, just like with many of the communist revolutions, had some legitimate basis.
You said that the Muslims took upon Jesus to be prophet.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In what respect does they?
It would depend on who you talk to. Many would see it was a clear case of a false prophet or charlatan. Many would say this was a great teacher and leader and rabbi, but not the Messiah. And that Christians, in fact, would claim that, you know, claim that Jesus never claimed to be the Messiah. This is something that a Jewish cult took upon themselves and happened to expand to become what we now know as Christianity. But again, that would you know, vary. There's no mention of Jesus in any holy texts of Judaism.
Well, that's
a
question.
You talked briefly about torture in Iran, and in the last 10 years, we've seen a lot of regimes all over the world, like the Marcos regime in the Philippines fall down, the junta in Chile. The government of Brazil, and where widespread torture was utilized means of repression. Do you think that now or in the next decade, because of the awareness of human rights, we're going to continue to see torture used as a means of repression?
It's less. I think, you know, I know more. I follow the Middle East more closely, and there is some very active human rights movements taking part throughout the Middle East. There are, within Israel, very strong Jewish-identified human rights movements opposing the government's policies in occupied territories. In the Arab world, where they're allowed to exist, to the extent they're allowed to exist, there are strong Muslim-identified human rights movements. A lot of regimes in here realize that torture can backfire. Indeed, you know, there are very few Iranians who don't have a family member who was tortured in the Shah's prison. Some years ago in the Shah, I remember going through some records in the Commerce Department where they talked about large-scale export by the U.S. Commerce Department of electric cattle prods to Iran. They don't raise cattle in Iran. These are used on people. They also, the U.S. also export these kind of round things that when people were tortured, They put these things in their head. The reverberation busts their eardrum from screaming and like electroshock. And the U.S. was aware of this. And this is not a secret. This report by Amnesty International and elsewhere. The CIA got former German SS officers as advisors to the SABA, the Shah's secret police, to train them in so-called interrogation techniques. And suddenly they get real self-righteous when they seize 50 American hostages at the embassy. And you know, I do this in my classroom, and especially several years ago, and everybody knew about the hostage crisis. And I said, how many knew about the U.S. overthrowing the constitutional government in 1953, the arming, training, and so on? Nobody. And so we get this attitude, there's crazy Muslims out there.
Yeah.
You know. And again, not that this justifies, you know, taking diplomats as hostages or terrorism or anything like that, but again, this has nothing to do with Islam. And it has everything to do with, and any more than the stuff that Israel, terrible things Israel's done to Palestinians, has anything to do with Judaism. It's a direct manifestation of the history of oppression and the reaction to it. And of course, you know, just as there have been many crimes committed in the name of Judaism and Islam, we certainly are painfully aware of great crimes committed in the name of Christianity.
Well, is there a movement that the Islamic religion is growing in the United States? People seem to think that it is being growing faster.
Yes, it's in fact, I just give an idea of how it was. I was giving I was a keynote speaker at a big annual forum at Gustavus Adolphus College, which is a Lutheran liberal arts school in Minnesota. And I met a physics professor there who was from this nice Norwegian Lutheran family, or actually Swedish Lutheran family, went to a graduate of Gustavus, looked the part. And but while he was in the Peace Corps in Malaysia, he married a Malaysian and converted to Islam. And he's a very devout practicing Muslim. And he's a very popular professor, couldn't, no other way of really telling him apart from any other professor there, or any good Lutheran or whatever, but he happened to be, a Muslim. It spread particularly, so there are some cases like this, which primarily spread among the African-American community. And I should mention that the majority of African-American Muslims are not black Muslims, not Nation of Islam, not Farrakhan people. They're a tiny minority of American Muslims. Indeed, most mainstream Muslims see Nation of Islam and Farrakhan as a heretic, because Islam preaches equality of races, tolerance and respect for Christians and Jews, etc. And of course, we've seen very different things from Nation of Islam. But
Malcolm discovered that.
Yes, and indeed, Malcolm X, in the final years of his life, that's why he wrote the Nation of Islam, became a more mainstream Muslim. I think it has, while Islam has a certain fatalistic element of predestination to it, there's also a very strong component that you are responsible for your own liberation, that God has brought you here to do justice and struggle for justice. And there's certain elements of that, of siding with the oppressed, which has, indeed, it's more explicit in many ways than a lot of people, especially in the liberation theology tradition in Latin America and elsewhere, have brought out elements of that of Christianity, but it's even more accessible, more directly, more widely accepted in Islam. So it's a very empowering force for historically oppressed people. So I think, again, especially in the African American community, there has been a strong growing number who have been attracted to Islam. Also, as many African Americans find that they were in fact Muslim, you know, their ancestors are Muslim prior to slavery in Africa, because Islam had spread well into West Africa prior to the slave trade.
I have a question about the maybe an action question and not appropriate here, but you mentioned several times that the CIA, which has a $30 billion black budget that nobody knows anything about,
has been behind this oppression and terrorism and violence in a number of countries against the, generally against the poor people. What's done over there is something else, but what is done in, by our government is important. You have to, each of us as a board, do you have any suggestion as to how we bring about a review of the CIA and what it's allowed to do? Well, this is what we always
sure,
get.
Sure. Yeah, but I think, yeah, I mean, I certainly think these CIA, I've certainly been a long-time critic of the CIA, and he's addressed reform, not an absolute abolition in my opinion, but I think it's also important to realize that every one of the misdeeds the CIA mentioned were with full knowledge and consent of our top elected officials and their cabinets and the highest people in the State Department. That these are not just some rogue operations. And these are people who are elected by us.
This gives them a mechanism that blanks out any report and any responsibility and any later review.
Indeed, we had, and we saw the whole Iran-Contra scandal. We had no hesitancy with operating with the Islam fundamentalists must serve their interests. In fact, one interesting thing I came about just recently was revealed that the CIA turned over the list of 1,000 members of the Iranian Communist Party they received from a Soviet defector, gave it to the mullahs, and tracked down them and massacred at least 600 of them. This is back during the Reagan administration. And again, with Afghanistan, we're willing to use Islamic extremists for our advantage. But of course, now, we're seeing that suddenly the Islamic, we have a green threat. The Islamic threat is replacing the communist threat as the big challenge to American interest and being used to justify a continued, essentially, Cold War era military budgets and the like. Indeed, the Clinton military budget this year is higher than in both real and absolute dollars than Nixon's last military budget, which is put in the height of the Cold War. I mean, reason given was this great threat, this Islamic threat that's coming along. And I'm sure we'll see similar debates as we did during the Cold War around third world intervention. Is the best way to challenge it to look at the underlying root causes or to respond by supporting live regimes, no matter how corrupt or oppressive, and having them try to keep the lid on the boiling pot down a little longer? As you can probably tell, by the way, rephrase the question, or my opinion is on it, but I think we're going to see, I'd like to extend your question to a broader one, is that we need to look real seriously about U.S. relations to the, and the Carmen's question as well, to look at a much broader issue of U.S. third world relations. Because I think in many ways, frankly, the anti-communist thing was more of an excuse than a real reason. That I think in many ways we were at least as afraid of indigenous nationalists who might challenge some of our prerogative or hegemony than we were with the Soviet Union per se. And similarly, that's why we see Islam, this Islamic resurgence, sort of something of a threat. But I think it's important we also recognize, again, the pluralism within Islam. That again, you do have some very, I traveled some with the, in Western Sahara. That's a country that was invaded by Morocco, American allies, some years ago, and fighting for their independence. They got the United Nations World Court on their side, but U.S. is heavily armed Morocco to make the military equation very, very difficult. And these people are devout Muslims. They are people who indeed say they practice the purest form of Islam because they're traditionally nomads and never had Islam as a state religion. And they argue that any religion becomes a state religion gets corrupted to defend the status quo of those in power. And they were, women were in leadership in this movement. Women were unveiled. They pointed out how, you know, Muhammad's first wife was a successful businesswoman who owned the house they lived in. His daughter was chosen successor. There are women warriors in the spread of Islam. That this stuff, there's nothing in the Quran about veils or anything like that. And basically, they talk about Ayatollah Khomeini and people like that, the way I think many of us would talk about Pat Robertson or Paula or somebody, that they are using the religion for their own reactionary political agenda. And so I think it's very important that we, you know, recognize the diversity within Islam and realize that a lot of the concerns they raise are legitimate, even as we at the same time are naive about the indeed very scary reactionary nature of many of these Islamic movements and some of these Islamic governments which have come to power in recent years.
You mentioned Bosnia in passing, but probably not really related to the topic, but I'd be happy to do that. But do you have any insights on intervention?
It's a nice challenge for stereotypes, I guess, that it was the Muslim who wanted a democratic, secular, European-style pluralistic democracy, where it was the Christians who wanted an ethnically pure and essentially religiously pure, because the only thing that makes the Croats different from the Serbs is, you know, Orthodox versus Catholic, and Muslims, they all speak the same language. They all speak Serbo-Croatian. Their facial features and, you know, everything. I mean, you couldn't tell one apart from the other. Yet the Serbs were able to use this, you know, fundamentalist threat in the heart of Europe kind of thing as an excuse for propaganda of terrifying Serbs, you know, side by side Muslims for years, no problem, into getting this reaction. It's very scary. That's what Hitler did with the Jews were living. Jews in the 20s in Germany were about as free as Jews had been anywhere in the world, as accepted, as assimilated as anywhere in the world. It's just frightening how quickly people can be manipulated into hating people because they're different. And again, just to go back to the other half of my lecture on Jews, there's not a Jew around, even one who's fairly safe and assimilated and comfortable, who doesn't have that deep fear that any time now, that could suddenly shift. Virtually every Jew is, in some level, consciously or otherwise, terrified, untrusting, that something's going to happen yet again. And again, many Muslims, in a different way, but in a different level, but still have the same kind of deep suspicion and mistrust. So I think we're about out of time here. I guess I'd like to conclude with, if you're talking to the Middle East, about the Middle East, Muslim, Jewish, to do a lot of listening. Do a lot of listening, because people need to talk and share their deepest fears and listen respectfully, even if they think they're totally off the wall. That to try through some of the garbage and propaganda and hysteria and prejudices, you find a kernel of fear, which does have a historical basis to it. Also, I think, you know, when one raises concerns, legitimate concerns, about the practices of certain Islamic-identified movements or the governments or practices of Israel, to do it within the context of we respect you, we think your survival is important, that I'm raising these concerns because I'm concerned about this kind of stuff everywhere, and not just singling out your group, and to say that I will stand by you, that I will stand up against any kind of anti-Jewish or anti-Muslim persecution that ever happens here. I'll be there for you. I'll interrupt any slanderous statement or joke or whatever, putting down you or your people. That I will be your ally against any kind of oppression that comes down against you. And we may have some political differences, but those are political differences, as it's not an attack on you or a lack of respect of you or your religious faith, or your tradition, or your culture, or your people. And I think that's really where I think we need to work. And if you're interested in some of the broader political questions about U.S. policy around there. Others I'll be doing workshops all this week and the following week on